Gentlemen, today's guest is going to talk about psychology for men with brains and balls. Ruwan is today's guest on the Manlyhood Mancast.
Men, this is your chance to strive for greatness, to be all you can be, to make your mark on history. Your chance to improve and sharpen yourself, to grapple with your weaknesses and turn them into strength. Welcome to the Manlyhood Mancast.
Hey fellas, grab your calendars because we've got an event coming up that you do not want to miss. So October 28th, which is a Saturday of 2023, from 5 o'clock to 8, we are going to relax and smash right on Minard Run in Bradford, Pennsylvania. It's an axe throwing place, and it's going to be our Manlyhood Season 7 launch party. We are celebrating the fact that we've been running for 10 years. We're celebrating that this is the launch of our 7th season, and we're celebrating over 700,000 downloads, well on our way to 1 million downloads. So get pumped for a killer night with hanging out with the guys, good times, and axe throwing. It's going to be great. So the folks at Relax and Smash are giving us a fantastic deal. Normally it costs 15 or 20 bucks if you want to throw. They're going to let us do it for $5 a person. And there's going to be a food truck on hand as well. So if you want to throw some axes, grab some dinner, hang out with the guys, and have a good time, that's what we're going to be doing on October 28th. From 5 to 8 p.m. So, yeah, it's going to be great. Bring your friends, invite your neighbors. Let's go party in style so that we can kick off this season 7 of the Manlyhood Mancast. Again, that's the Manlyhood Mancast season 7 launch party, and it's happening on October 28th, 2023, from 5 to 8 at Relax and Smash on Minard Run in Bradford, PA. Listen, even if you're from out of town, this is worth coming into town for because we're going to have a good time. So come join us and celebrate together. See you guys there.
This is the Manlyhood Mancast.
Gentlemen, welcome to the Manlyhood Mancast. I'm glad that you guys are here with us. I always am so excited to bring you a new season, and this is the start, the launch of season 7, and we have got a fantastic interview for you today. It's with Ruwan Mipagala, and he goes by Ruwan because it's probably easier to say, but I hope I got his last name pronounced correctly. Either way, though, this guy is fantastic. He has been featured on platforms like BBC, Bloomberg, Ask Men, Psychology Today, among others. And before we get into our conversation with him, let's just talk about his podcast. It's called Ruwando, and it's called Psychology for Men with Brains and Balls. He's got a really unique perspective, and I think we have a great conversation. So you guys, let's get right into it. Ruwan, it's great to have you on the show today. Thanks for being with us, man.
Yeah, good to meet you. Yeah, actually, of all the podcasts I've been already, this is the coolest podcast name. As soon as I saw it, I was like, Manlyhood, that's a good name.
That's awesome. Yeah, so 10 yeah. years ago, I workshopped the whole thing with like a group of guys that I thought were going to be like my team to make it happen, and asked them a bunch of questions, and we looked to see what domain names were available, and we had like 1,000 different possibilities, and this one just kind of stuck with everybody. And then they were all like, okay, great, good to have fun. And then I realized this was on me to do and not my team that I thought I was putting together. So, but yeah, it's been pretty cool. It's a lot of fun, and had the chance to interview some really interesting people and connect with some great men and help them become even better men. So
nice.
Yeah, man, tell me about the work that you're doing, because you've got a great podcast with a great name as well, right?
Well, it's my name, basically. Ruwando podcast. Yeah. It's gone through many phases as I've gone through different phases. Where I'm at now, I got really into looking at history, mainly because, you know, I think this is something you tackle as well, is like when seeing how culture was trying to define, redefine masculinity, seeing the confusion there, I was like, we don't actually need to define anything new. Like, this has existed. Like, masculinity has existed before we could have put a label on it even. So I got really into history. I'm also quite into like Jungian psychology and stuff in the mind. And that's basically what I draw from when it comes to men's development, even when it comes down to practical things, relationships, sexuality, being a father. I'm a new dad, so this is what I'm thinking about a lot now, in a more concrete version than when I was like thinking more abstractly of like, oh yeah, the king archetype, blah blah blah. Like, no, I'm a dad now, so there's obviously certain practical virtues that are important. And yeah, basically anything I find interesting, I try to turn it. I'm a bit of a nerd, whether it's history or psychology or biology or whatever. And I think there's lessons in all of that.
Yeah, I was paying attention to, I think it was a promo for one of your courses, and you talked a little bit about, like, you started to just kind of hint on, like, there's a lot of reasons why culture is abandoning the ideas of manhood, and it could be this, but we're not going to sit here and complain about it. We're just going to move forward, which I think is a very manly approach.
Mm-hmm. I think it's... I'm guilty of maybe over-romanticizing the past. Like, I think a lot of us do, especially here we are. We have the luxury of talking about, you know, here we are on a podcast, right? It's like pretty comfortable compared to, say, our Paleolithic ancestors. And we can say, oh, their lives were like, those were real men, right? But obviously there's things about that life that maybe we wouldn't choose to have rather than the lives we have. But, you know, every stage there have been challenges. Every stage, you know, there's never been an easy time. There's always something to complain about. And the only practical thing is you're not going to change the time you're in or the culture you're in, not really, or the world, you know, as a whole or immediately. It's just like, suck it up and take care of business.
Yeah, I think a lot about the cycle, you know, the hard men, the weak men, you mm-hmm. know, that whole concept there. And I think that you see it throughout history, but I think like for a long time, you know, I mean, I think the cycle has some relevance, especially in our postmodern and modern framework. But I think even before that, man, like, while I'm sure there were times that it was difficult, I think things were just so different, you know, mm-hmm. hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago. It was like people didn't have the luxury of thinking.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, let's just fight and survive, man. Like, that's what we've got, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so whose life is better? I mean, there's certain new challenges for men, especially young men now. There were other kinds of challenges back then. Yeah, I think you said it perfectly. It's like, life back then was harder but simpler. Like, you didn't have a lot of the problems of today with men, and maybe people in general, are the fact that we have too much choice. There's nothing, we're not forced. Very few of us are forced to do something. Like, if anything, we have to go on a journey to find our calling or something that is great for a Hallmark movie. But back in the day, it wasn't like, you know, the movies that we like, even Marvel movies, the hero doesn't have a choice. And for most of history, men didn't have a choice. They just had to, you know, they would literally get weeded out of existence if they didn't have certain virtues. Now we have to like choose to go hiking, choose to work out, choose to do hard things because we don't have to.
Yeah, and it's a crazy world.
Yeah.
I think about it a lot, dude. I went to Africa years ago. Just going to tell a quick story, and I think mm-hmm. it might make sense. But I went to Africa, and I was explaining to them. They looked at me, and I'm a large man, and they're like, you must be the richest man in your village. And I'm like, no, man, you don't understand. Here in America, like, if you're poor, you can afford, you know, macaroni and cheese and hot dogs, and that's about it, you know? And if you're rich, then you can have more healthier options. And for them, it was so backward because they were eating, you know, like the fresh vegetables was the cheap food, you know, it was cheap to get that for them. And to get the convenience foods was much more expensive. And it was just very flip-flopped, and it blew their mind to hear, they laughed, you know, at the backwardness of the way that the culture has kind of viewed things.
Where in Africa?
I went to West Africa in Guinea. So I was there for about 10 days or so. It was a pretty neat experience. So,
yeah, I've been seeing videos of like the Maasai and the Hadza. Have you seen What is a Woman? Yeah, like where he goes and visits the Hadza. Yeah, I mean, something about that, like that's the kind of old life that I romanticize, where like the culture is so defined and they don't have existential questions because they are trying to survive. It's like that's the trade-off. But right. Yeah, I think, you know, it's so interesting looking at those cultures. Also seeing from an athletics perspective, they can all jump so high. I just saw this on Instagram because their tendons are so strong as they're walking barefoot. They can jump like insane heights, and they don't work out. They just like try to not die.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. So tell me a little bit more about the work that you're doing with men.
Yeah, so I have a few online programs. I teach some workshops. I'm teaching a couples workshop with my wife where I'm going to work with the men more and she's going to work with the women. But what I've been mainly doing for the last 10-ish years is coaching men one-on-one. The two big problems men have are with intimacy or with life purpose, and very often with both. And there's usually similar kinds of issues. I was just speaking to a guy earlier today where he just like, whether it's due to shame or conditioning or whatever, we didn't even dig into it. He has an issue or a inhibition with admitting to himself what he wants, whether it's with women or whether it's with his career. So he takes, you know, he takes the, how can I put this? The not ideal option, whether it's with the women he dated or the career he's ended up in. And I guess things like that are pretty common. Like there's similar themes. And obviously these two things are survival and replication, like women and money, essentially, or women and purpose. So that's usually where most of the meaning is in a man's journey.
So let's talk about the purpose aspect for a little bit. Like how does a man find his purpose? If he's like, because I know a lot of guys who like, they don't get it. Like they're like, well, my purpose is to, you know, to do this, but then, you know, they lose that and then they feel purposeless. So like, how do you find that? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's kind of going back to what we were saying of like, for most of history, you didn't have to think about this because your purpose was to not die, make babies, make sure they don't die. And like, you know, there weren't many ways to do that. Now survival is so far away, and you see, you know, and even replication is so far away from our day-to-day concern that it is hard, right? Like I look at some of the most successful people I know, maybe who started a tech startup or whatever, and this is not to disparage their profession, but they're creating things that really aren't necessary. Like they're not. And even honestly, I can point this to myself, not that I'm uber successful, but like, you know, there was a time where working with your hands in these jobs that maybe are seen as blue collar and less important by a lot of society were the most important thing. And like this was your purpose. Like you just make sure you don't die and feed your family. Like that's what it was. So anyway, that's basically a non-answer. It's some combination of what you find interesting, what is useful to other people, and obviously can sustain you. And this is something that like in a business class 101 would come up with, like the three-part Venn diagram. And I think as far as like finding it, the advice I give to guys is see what you're naturally interested in. Like this is actually one of the first lessons in my archetype challenge is what are you randomly interested in, right? Like what kind of podcasts are you drawn to? Are you into MMA? Is there something that you, when you're doom scrolling, this is what you end up looking at? There's probably something in there that is your natural proclivity. And maybe you have no skills in it, but the interest is what will give you the skills or will give you the follow through to develop the skills. And then as far as finding a way to, you know, obviously people have to provide for themselves and make a living. That's where I guess the business marketing, you know, figuring out. And I think that's in itself its own hero's journey. Because I talk to a lot of guys who quit their comfortable job to go on this kind of journey of finding meaningful work. And it is really difficult. You know, I don't think you could just think about it like journaling on a pen and piece of paper. Like you have to kind of try things and fall down and skin your knees, so to speak. And then somehow I think it finds you. Like you were saying earlier, you know, you had a different vision with manlyhood, but then here you are doing something else. And this is just how it is, doing it yourself. And maybe this is what the way, you know, it's meant to be if you want to look at it kind of from a storybook perspective.
So something you said a minute ago that kind of brings me a little pause. And I'm like, you know, when I'm doom scrolling, the thing that I end up most interested in is those singing cat videos. So maybe that's... I can get my daughter's cat to talk to me, but I can't get him to sing yet. So,
yeah, maybe there's something there. Who knows?
Yeah, no, I just, but I do appreciate that concept. So tell me more about the archetypes. You know, I mean, I know, you know, I mean, Joseph Campbell, you know, has the whole, you know, the hero's journey archetypes and everything else. Like, how do you frame those things? Do they look a little different in your kind of perspective? Yeah.
Well, I've read a lot of Jung, and like his basic definition, or, you know, his concept of it is kind of like genes. They are patterns that have persisted generation to generation because they're useful to people, right? So like what we call the hero or the warrior are basically like testosterone driven traits that maintain themselves in the human psyche rather than in the genome, because it's useful for men to be warriors, or what all the emotions and feelings and tendencies that go with that: competitiveness, well-placed aggression, you know, a sense of honor is a big one. Like, honor is like a really important cultural meme, because societies that didn't, where the men didn't have some sense of honor, they got taken over and enslaved by cultures that did. So like that was like a really important like human advancement, was like to perceive honor. So archetypes are basically like collections of that, like the warrior's honor and aggression and courage mixed in together. You know, the thing that we might call the king archetype commonly is basically an extension of fatherhood, maybe fatherhood applied to your people rather than just your biological family, and all the things that we could put a label on. The lover is what's useful for a man in the bedroom or in romance, the whatever words you want to come up with. That's essentially what an archetype is. It's like a behavioral pattern that's useful, and they're in us, right? Like thousands of generations back, there were men who, even though maybe they didn't watch the NFL because that didn't exist, they were interested in that same kind of thing, and we can call that the warrior archetype, if you will, or whatever you want to call it. And I think it's really important, since we can't change our biology, we can't change our psyche, at least the stuff that we evolved to have, it's important to understand these things. And like, when I see a lot of the shaming of masculinity, especially young men, is recognizing we have certain things, right? Like, a dog is born with a taste for meat. Boys are typically born with like a drive for aggression or different things. And it's not about changing them, it's about finding what's the nail for all these hammers, basically, or the nails for the hammer.
Right. Right. So, I've heard you talk about the masculine archetype, and that, would you say that encompasses kind of a broad spectrum of those kind of individual archetypes?
Yeah, I mean, the way I define it, just like to take it out of like the spiritual realm, is like the masculine archetype are all the behaviors that we associate with testosterone, you know, and it covers all of those things, right? And there's different applications, right? You wouldn't act, you know, the way in a fight that you would with your daughter, but they're both expressions of masculinity. Like, there's a certain feeling that every father gets, in whether in affection or protection of their kid, you know, and this is actually shown, you know, when Jung came up with these ideas, it was before medicine was very advanced. Like, now we can measure things like testosterone and see, and there's, you know, studies that show you pump someone with testosterone, they have the same kinds of behaviors. All of us. Like, it's like a unidirectional thing. So like, it's pretty concrete. And, you know, I would say that masculinity, therefore, is not something that needs to be defined or redefined. It is pretty concrete as what it is.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times, I have had some guests on, G.S. Youngblood, great guy, and a few others, and they talk about, and I think this may come from, I'm not even sure where it comes from, but I know I've heard it from, like, Data, you know, and some others, where they talk about how a man has, or every person has a masculine and a feminine energy, and I don't mm-hmm. know where you stand on that, but I always kind of feel like, no, I don't have a feminine energy. Like, if I have nurturing or caring in me, that's also a masculine trait. Right? It's just a masculine trait expressed through manhood. And if a woman does it, it's expressed through womanhood. Now, I would think that, you know, there are typical behaviors that are, you know, like, you know, if, for example, right, like Mr. T and Mr. Rogers, you know, you compare those two guys and they're like very, very different, but they're both masculine, right? And they're mm-hmm. expressing themselves in a masculine way. So, like, when we, I don't know where you stand on the whole, you know. Yeah.
Well, I love that you brought up those two guys, because I love them both. And like, yeah, have you seen the documentary on Mr. Rogers?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, I love it. I've watched it a bunch of times. It's such a tearjerker for me, because like he was so sweet, right? Like, he was not aggressive. Like, he was a very specific kind of man, but he was such a fucking man, right? Like when he took on the senators who wanted to cancel public broadcasting, like his balls were huge, right? Like, you can't question that. And he was a preacher. I mean, he was a priest. Like, he was like so sweet and opposite. And like, you know, what you just like comparing those two guys and seeing what's in common between them, I think is so interesting because their expressions are so different. But to your question about like, does a man have a feminine side? I think, you know, again, it's kind of like labeling of like, you call whatever you want. I would reduce it down to, yeah, every guy, unless he's a total sociopath, feels an emotion that maybe we would associate more with women because your oxytocin receptors get stimulated when you see a cute cat video or when your daughter does something cute or like any, you know, it's there, right? It's the same emotion. The degree of that emotion or how much you'll cry during a movie that your wife will bawl out to is obviously different because we literally have less oxytocin receptors. But, you know, I would say, you know, if there's any feminine side, I argued this with Jack Donovan when he was on my podcast. It's like, yeah, your oxytocin receptors, we could say, are your feminine side. Like, the thing that makes you think things are cute, I would say that's your feminine side if there is anyone. Because in the same way that testosterone correlates with every trait, obviously, that we consider masculine, mm-hmm. most feminine traits are basically stimulation of oxytocin. And, you know, if maybe people, it's a little dry of a way to look at it, but I would say that's basically it.
Yeah, I saw a guy today who had made a Facebook post, and he said he was talking about how it, you know, he doesn't, like, a man shouldn't, like, when a man says, I have a strong wife, he usually means I have a disobedient wife, or I have a wife who is not submissive, you know, and how we shouldn't use strong to define our wives. I'm like, have you ever sat next to a woman while she's giving birth? Don't tell me she's not strong. You know what I mean? Like, it's
totally.
It's just feminine strength and masculine strength. Strength is a human condition, you know, and it gets expressed as a person, you know, it gets expressed through gender, you know.
But yeah, during when my wife was giving birth, you know, there's the midwife and the doula, there's like a bunch of women, and I was kind of just there as a support character, right? You know, I'm here to help, but I've no part in it, right? Like, the women were there like coaching my wife, who was her first birth. And I was like, wow, this is kind of like, it kind of feels like a locker room pep talk slash, you know, halftime on the football game slash maybe even we could say like right before battle. Like, this is like women's battle. Like, it's really intense. They're all there for each other. And men don't really have a place. Like, I felt like, you know, I'm here to get you a glass of water, but I don't really have anything to add other than, you know, just trying to be supportive. Like, you know, yeah. So to your point, yeah, there's different fields, let's say, for the same kind of virtues.
Yeah, I like that. How old's your daughter? Or did you? Was it a daughter?
Daughter. Yeah, one and a half, almost 15 months. Yeah, that's cool. Or 16 months. Yeah,
I have a granddaughter about that age, and that's awesome, dude. Like, they're fun.
Wait, how old are you?
How old? So I get this question a lot. So I'm actually I just turned 45.
Okay.
And I had my wife and I got married, you know, pretty young, and then we had twins in our 1 year wedding anniversary, and each of a son and a daughter, and they've each given us a grandbaby so far. But people are like, you don't look that old. And I'm like, well, the fat pushes out the wrinkles. So.
Yeah, but no. Also 45 granddad. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that was the goal, to be young enough to enjoy the grandkids. So,
You'll be around for your great grandkids for sure.
That's the hope.
Yeah.
So
nice.
What in this 15 months that you've had so far is your favorite part of fatherhood?
I don't know what to say without sounding corny, but when I can see how much she loves me and like we have those little moments, it's like, oh, this is what everything's for. It's like, it is the biggest injection of mindfulness or peace or whatever someone tries to strive for with any philosophy. Like, it is, and you know, it feels like you're tapping into something spiritual. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, that's the only thing I could put on it.
Doesn't sound corny, you know,
and it also, you know, obviously every parent probably feels that it inspires you to be a better version of yourself. But I have been thinking, obviously, because I think about development a lot, like every moment that she's observing me, which is every moment that I'm around her, she is picking up something, right? Like so much of, let's say, Freudian style psychology and personal development is blaming your parents for how they messed you up. I do think, I don't necessarily, you know, take that as a model, but I do think like, okay, if I'm getting, you know, worked up about something I shouldn't, or if I'm, you know, speaking to my wife in a way that I shouldn't, or like basically not meeting my own standards, this is negatively affecting her probably in some way. So it's like, I have a bigger reason to be the person I want to be anyway. You know, I'm affecting someone else rather than just myself. And it's like a great motivation to be who I want to be ultimately.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's like some of the rewards are tangible, you know, when it's, and you'll start to see it, especially when she starts really talking, you know, and interacting and, you know, you'll start seeing some real tangible rewards where you're like, okay, my kid's getting it. But there's still nothing cooler than when you've got an adult kid who like does something that surprises you, you know, and you're like, wow, you know, you're like, I have a son who would never eat vegetables growing up, you know, and like you go over to his house and he's like cooking this meal and he's putting all these vegetables in it. And it's like, what happened to you? You're getting it. Wow. You get a sense of pride, you know, when you see, and it starts, I mean, it happens all the way through when you start seeing them make choices for themselves. That's a cool moment, dude.
What's it like being a grandfather?
Dude, that's like the joy that you get right now. Like it's slightly tempered, right, by the fact that you still have to clean up, you know, poopy diapers and have screaming in the middle of the night. So like,
I don't know if the mic's picking it up, but she's actually screaming downstairs.
I love it. Yeah. So you've got that, right? So it like tempers that, like that joy. You've got that little bit of like, oh my gosh, this is so hard. You get like all the joy with none of the hard, or at least a small amount of the hard. It's great.
Cool. Yeah. I see that in my parents. Yeah. They're having a good time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an awesome experience.
Yeah. Oh, and you had twins. That must've been really intense.
Yeah. 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 It was awesome. So, And we could talk about that more because we're going to do an interview here on the Manly Man Cast, and then I'm going to show up on your podcast. So we can talk more about that then.
Yeah. Today, I'll bookmark that. You,
so.
For sure.
So tell me, so I think I saw, are you living overseas now?
We actually just moved back to the States, like days ago. I was in Mexico for a year, and before that I was in Thailand for 5 years. I didn't expect to end up in the States, but I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, so you're kind of world traveled then. You've gotten to see, had lots of experiences, and
yeah, I mean, I was in Asia for a while, and then my wife and I actually met in South America. She moved to Thailand for me. She hated it, so we went to Mexico. Then we found out we didn't like Mexico, so we're actually planning. This is just a couple of weeks ago we decided that we're going to get a trailer, like a fifth wheel or something, and travel around the country while the kid's still small.
That's awesome. That'd be a cool experience. Yeah. I put down roots, so it's hard for me to, you know, I've got a friend we just met the other day who is like, but they did the same thing, and they're, you know, they're like our age. So they're like ready to, you know, roll. And I'm like, man, I don't think I can dig at my roots now, man. I don't want to move. I like where I'm at. So, but I guess everybody's different kind of in where they, I live in the middle of nowhere. So in Pennsylvania, about 2 hours from Buffalo, New York, and 2 hours from, or 3 hours from Pittsburgh. And there's like nothing else anywhere near us. So it's great. Great. There's national forest all around us. And
nice. I love it. Maybe we'll roll through that area. I went to school in Buffalo.
Oh, so I know the area. Yeah. So then you should come up through. When you come up through, holler and we'll get together and we'll go for a hike or something.
Cool. Awesome.
So, yeah, man, tell me more about, are you working on a book, or have you written your book already?
It's mostly written. I serialized it and it's out on my Substack. I put out a chapter every week. It's a memoir. Maybe you saw I was in a cult when I was in my early 20s. It was specifically a female run cult. So ironically, I learned a lot about masculinity in an environment that maybe started out as what feminists would think of as utopia. And even I thought it, that at first when I was in it, but then, there's a dark side to everything. And, you know, and you see what happens when masculinity is kind of dampened, or men are kind of turned into kind of happy secondary citizens, you know? So yeah, anyway, I learned a lot. I mean, I developed a lot as a human being, and it's a good story. So I you know, I put it
to the paper. So I don't want to take away from the opportunity for people to go to your Substack and read all that, but dude, you got to tell me more about this.
Sure.
So how did this happen?
Yeah, so in college, I was already obsessed with personal development because I felt like I had things I needed to fix about myself, right? I was low in confidence and many other things like that. And I obsessively rewatched TED Talks because I felt like that was the best way to enlighten myself. Podcasts weren't a thing, I don't think, back then, or at least they weren't popular. And I caught a TED Talk by the founder. She gave a talk about like connection. And also, I should say, around this time, I was absorbing a lot of like the pickup artist community's literature because that was what was on the internet for men looking for help. And I dabbled in that. I gained some things. I gained also, I think, had some negative effects where like I basically didn't know how to process emotions. I didn't know how to feel my feelings. And even though I knew all of these ways to like socially interact from like a very left brain engineer's perspective, you know, I think it just gave me more anxiety, honestly. So this stuff that I saw in this TED talk by this woman, Nicole, she was speaking about orgasm in like a spiritual kind of pseudo tantric way. I thought it was very fascinating, talking about like how to really connect with other people. That was very interesting. And, you know, I was a lot more liberal as a young person, you know, liberal with a small L, but also politically. And it just seemed interesting, like a society run by women where like there's no competition and stuff. It just was appealing for me where I was already insecure about my masculinity. So I went in there. There was a lot of adventures to be had. You know, this is kind of like the thing I think is most interesting. A lot of people focus on the sex stuff, but I think the most interesting thing is that it was kind of a sociological experiment, kind of like the Stanford Prison Experiment, but all encompassing. Like we lived in a house. It was kind of like an ashram, like a spiritual ashram, but devoted to like sexual practices. It ran on a very feminine culture, which is like the sociological thing that's interesting. Like, you know, emotional communication was really important. Non-competition was important. There's a lot of the norms were backwards in this society. And it was really interesting to see how people behave when certain cultural constructs were removed. Even though it was a feminist utopia, there were still power dynamics. They just were less obvious. There's a lot of brainwashing. There's a lot of what we see actually kind of in wokeism or any cultural movement that becomes culty. Obviously, you see in a cult. So I feel like I have a very clear perspective when it comes to culture war arguments because I see what would happen if you made the society really small and run the simulation with different moral values. Like I did that once at least. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say about it, but yeah, it was a really interesting time and I think draws a lot of parallels to basically how cultures develop.
So, like, I know a lot of guys who have been through, like, a bad situation with women, for example, and then they just turn bitter. Like, would you say that, do you have to fight, maybe, to not be bitter after that, or did you, like, how did you come back from that?
Yeah, well, I would say, all right, so there's a lot of things in the red pill world that I find extremely useful. Like, I actually recommend Rolo's book to a lot of guys, especially guys with like hardcore nice guy syndrome or who their model of reality is a little bit too soft. Sometimes they need the hard-hitting truth. But my biggest issue with red pill in general is that it doesn't see women's experience as like a human experience. I don't want to use the word empathize because it might be taken the wrong way, but like one of the biggest things I got from being in One Taste, that was the name of the organization, and that society was really seeing the world from a female perspective took away a lot of intimidation, resentment, fear. You know, I didn't want to live that way. In a sense, like men did get treated as second-class citizens. And like actually, funny enough, in that society, being called masculine was kind of an insult. Like, oh, you're being too masculine, meaning you're being too in your head, maybe too competitive, not empathic enough. So actually, no, I'm not bitter at all. If anything, that experience taught me, like, not to go full red pill where you, because I don't think red pill in itself is misogynist, but it just doesn't empathize enough, and it's so fear driven. Like, a lot of the power dynamics are fear driven. It's not that the assessment is wrong. I think I agree with a lot of what Rolla says about how intersexual dynamics are. But then the advice comes from this hyper resentful, hyper fearful place where ultimately connecting with women and having fulfilling relationships, short term, long term, whatever, is not that hard. You know, you don't have to be intimidated. So really, I'm not resentful at all at women or bitter at women because of that. And if anything, when I'm, say, helping a guy through a divorce where there's a lot of good justification usually to be bitter, I'm really trying to get them to reduce their fear, because that'll reduce their resentment and it'll help them recognize ultimately that you can have a great relationship. Just because she was not a great one or she treated you poorly, or really actually going tying in the archetype stuff, it's like so much of our personalities are not static. Right, if she was being a huge B to you, it probably was because you were being a little bitch too, right? Like, mm-hmm. You know, like a woman's, any person's nastiest side doesn't come out in a vacuum. It comes out because, you know, perpetrators become perpetrators when someone acts like a victim to a degree. So anyway, my message to guys who are feeling bitter towards women is recognizing that you actually have a lot of control of how people treat you, including women, which brings the onus back on you, which gives you, I think, anyone a greater sense of power. And because any resentment and bitterness comes from an assumption you're powerless to the actions of someone else. So yeah,
that's awesome.
This is the Manlyhood Mancast.
I think a lot about, you know, you mentioned wokeism, and which I hate the term because I feel like it's so buzzwordy that nobody understands what's really happening there. It's really Marxism, cultural Marxism, which is the idea that you have a power structure that needs to be torn down, and then they replace it with a new power structure. But what they don't understand is that they don't see 5, 10 years, 20 years down the road when that power structure is now out of hand and needs to be torn down, and it's just a cycle of tearing down.
Totally. You know, they see.
And so that's really what wokeism is Marxism. And that sounds a lot like what was happening there, is they're like, we're going to just tear down this power structure and say, you know, smash the patriarchy. And I'm always like, you know, I think patriarchy and matriarchy are not a dichotomy. I think that they're supposed to be a partnership, you know? I think we're supposed to mm-hmm. have men own their power and women own their power, and we work together. Like, I think that's what it's supposed to be. But somewhere along the line, everybody decides I'm got to be in all the power.
Yeah. 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 The thing is, though, I mean, if society truly was run by women and there were indigenous societies that were a little bit more balanced or more leaning towards the female point of view, they didn't grow very much. Like, you kind of have to be testosterone driven to grow a nation. And I do think, you know, what I would consider the patriarchy, if there is such a thing, I mean, it's basically the fact that civilization developed by men for men simply because they were competing with each other. And if there was a female run tribe that was all about like love and connection and nurturing, they got conquered. So that's the only reason. Like, it's not because anyone wanted to oppress women. It's just that security became a big deal when there were Mongol hordes or whatever, like marauders coming to take the women and children. Like, men had to, society had to shift towards a male perspective. And actually, to what you were saying about Marxism, are you familiar with Nietzsche's idea behind nobility, like master morality, slave morality?
So I'm actually not super familiar with Nietzsche. I'm kind of working my way through some other philosophers right now, and I haven't really touched Nietzsche yet. So tell me.
Yeah. But basically, I mean, this is a very simplified understanding. He's like, there's two kinds of morality. There's master morality and slave morality. Master morality is kind of like normal people morality, or what most men, what we consider to be powerful, simply because if you're the master class of a society, you do whatever you want. You have freedom of expression. You tell the truth because you have no reason to lie, right? You just, like, why would you lie if you have all the power, right? And that's how we should be as people. Like, it's more natural, it's more authentic, it's also more self-serving and, you know, backing up of the virtues we see in masculinity. Whereas slave morality evolved from people who were conquered, they have to make sure the masters don't hit them. So they start to lie. They start to bend the truth. They start to lie to themselves. They start to accept things that they don't actually want because they have to. And, you know, separate from master-slave classes, you see this in society like Marxism, wokeism. You know, this is driven by slave morality, this idea that, you have to fight against oppression. That's your biggest thing. Because if you were a literal slave, this is what would matter to you, right? But it seeps into society where people who don't need to think that way, especially men who don't need to think that way, are now lying to themselves, you know, making themselves small, acting, you know, basically distorting their natural drives. And the thing is, though, if you look at history, every revolution is driven by slave morality, right? Because if you're the master class, you're not going to revolt. And this is maybe natural. There's a natural revolution cycle. But every time they come to power, they have to switch to master morality. Otherwise, they'll lose their power. So even like when you look at some of the Marxist groups, when they get power, the Soviet Union, Stalin's rise, or this is, satirized in Animal Farm. When they come to power, they act like the landowners. They act like the capitalists. They fought. Like, that's the only way, as a strategy, you can maintain power is to be the oppressor. So it is a cycle, and the irony is with Marxism is that they try to hold on to this belief system that they cannot maintain if they want to maintain power.
Well, and then the other bottom line is then you've got people that have been in power the whole time and just play whatever side of the...
yeah, exactly.
They just keep the power and they just keep manipulating and getting everybody arguing and fighting instead of actually... I think about that a lot with the Soviet. Yes, there was a revolution, but like, dude, there were... The rich people stayed rich, and everybody else got poor, I mean, they took out the head... And then everybody else that was like right underneath that just stayed rich and stayed in power, but they just called it something different,
Yeah. I think with like corporate, like if you look at, say, the Bud Light thing, right? They were, and many companies really tried to appeal to the extreme left, to wokeism, Marxism, and they suffered for it. Like someone in that corporate office who knows what the conversations were so sure that if they pandered to the far left, they would make more money, right? Because that's what corporations do. That's why anyone would do that. But they lost money. So like, they're actually not in that group that I would think that corporations of all groups would actually know what's practical. But even they were blinded. So there's someone else who's profiting that maybe is more wise and even deeper in the power structure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can trace that to a couple of corporations that basically own majority stock and lots of stock in all of these big corporations. So like you look at Budweiser, that's Anheuser-Busch, and when you look at the parent companies and what they own, it's massive. When you look at Disney, they own everything, And then you look at, Vanguard and BlackRock and all these other corporations, they're owning it kind of from the back end. And they're the ones that are really pushing the agenda that says we're going to focus on the environment, we're going to focus on social justice, we're going to focus on governance. And so they're pushing this and they're making these corporations adopt these policies. And then, we could get on the socioeconomic craze. It's just nuts. So like, they're the ones responsible for making sure that they get their people in to these companies who push these agendas. And nobody, like, they stop. The concept used to be, if I'm a company, my job is to make profit for myself and the shareholders of my company. And somewhere along the line, there was this concept called stakeholder profit, which is, so like Coca-Cola, I might not own any shares of Coca-Cola, but if Coca-Cola fails, that affects other people too, right? So they started pushing this stakeholder concept. So instead of being concerned about who has a share in the company, they're pushing the idea of who has a stake in the company. In other words, whose life is affected if this company fails or succeeds. And that's where they started pushing in just a ridiculous philosophy that, dude, it's crazy. Jordan Peterson has expounded on this a lot. If you ever really want to dive into his podcast and listen, he's been talking about this a lot, and it's just, it's bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. The money ends up talking. Yeah. But the thing is, like, obviously, whoever's really pushing for those moves in Bud Light or whatever, might have gotten demoted, lost their job. I mean, there's some negative repercussion because ultimately the corporation exists to make money, at least, you know, at that level. So, yeah, I guess they're probably going to course correct.
I think this was an awakening that people hadn't seen in a long time, because there hasn't really been. They talked for years, you know, like, I mean, I'm a Christian, but, you know, there was always, like, back in the 90s, they were always talking about boycotting Disney, you know, and it didn't make a difference because they were so massive, you know, so they would boycott Disney and then it didn't make a difference, you know, it didn't hurt them at all for a handful of, you know, Southern Baptists or whatever to stop buying Disney VHS tapes, you know, it didn't hurt them at all. But now, I mean, we just saw this, like, this Disney Indiana Jones movie, like, barely, you know, barely performed in comparison to a no-name movie put out by a no-name company that Disney passed on, you know, because people are voting with their, you know, they're telling these companies now. I think that power didn't, I don't think it was there for a while. I don't think it mattered, but now people are starting to wake up, which is kind of interesting and neat to watch it unfold.
What were the Christians going to boycott for in the 90s?
That was like the rise of the religious right. And so, like, Jerry Falwell and all the big televangelist guys that were really pushing for a moral majority. So at that time, you know, Disney was leaning more to the left. And then they infused way too much politics into Christianity, I think, to be honest with you. So they're, you know, the typical stance, especially then in the 90s, was, you know, it was a pro-life stance. And it was a, you know, they were anti-homosexual stance. And similar, like there was always talk of all the secret messages hidden in the Disney movies. You know, I'm sure you've seen those videos where, you know, like, you know, good teenagers take off your clothes is whispered in an Aladdin song or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I don't know whether any of that was in there or not. I think a lot of it was just, you know, people just telling you that it was in there. But I think that was the big push. And then, you know, and that was about the same time that Disney bought ABC. And so ABC had some programming that, you know, that these people didn't like, and they decided they were going to boycott. But it didn't, and nobody ever did. You know, it was just like, but there was, you know, there were that time frame, the religious right was very ineffective in that they just came across as jerks and not as actually trying to help anybody, you know? So, you know, like I mean, I'm still a Christian and I'm still involved with things, and I still probably even agree with some of their stances on things, but I also have Disney Plus and I loved Star Wars. So, you know, like, I don't think you necessarily have to boycott everything. I think you can just make your voice heard. And then if something is too far, yeah, you can boycott it, you know, and you could say, look, this is enough. I'm done with this. And that's what happened right now. You know, that's what we're seeing now is people are like, I've had enough. I'm not going to buy your stuff anymore. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I think that now that is out there and it's making a difference, I think it's gonna start changing culture again a little bit. I think people have had enough. Just kind of crazy.
Yeah, I've been having these kinds of arguments/debates with some of my friends in New York who are more left leaning than me. Like we get along, but like there's the big argument was which way is culture going, and I feel like culture is for because there's evidence you could find of both things, but for me, the defining factor is that comedians are now considered conservative. Like for almost all of my life, comedians were liberal, right? They would make fun of George Bush. They would make fun of, because like the conservatives were painted as like this boring, humorless class, and comedians would make fun of them. And now it's the opposite. Comedians are considered conservative pretty much across the board, making fun of like the left because the left is in power. And I feel like comedy is the thing, is the thing that points you to where we're going to correct to. So I just think it's interesting because it's only been in the last few years that comedians are considered conservative.
Yeah, I love it because, you know, when they go after like Russell Brand or Joe Rogan or these guys, and those guys are left, and they're left wing. They always have been.
They're 90s left wing.
Yeah, the edge of the wing has been blown out, you know? So, yeah. I think about like this too, like change in a culture never happens in a single generation. right? And so if we keep that in mind, and if you ask that question, where's culture going? Well, the people that are actually having and raising children, you know, that aren't, you know, having abortions and that aren't, you know, being in relationships that don't produce children, the people that are actually having and raising children, so, and they're leaning more one direction, you know, more conservative. And so I think, you know, I think we're going to see a shift in the next 30, 40 years where we're going to see more Hispanic culture start to change. And Hispanics typically are more conservative as well. So, mm-hmm. You know, there's the Catholic influence there. So I think we're going to see some big, big shifts in the next, you know, the next generation is going to be pretty conservative.
Yeah, I mean, ideas do transfer not through family, too. That was Richard Dawkins' whole idea behind the meme. It's like Catholicism, or being a Catholic priest obviously doesn't pass down through a family because priests don't have kids, but right, the idea right. does, right? It spreads enough that there's always going to be more Catholic priests. So, I don't know if we want to get into this, but that's like the argument against the whole groomer thing. It's like, obviously, they don't have children, but they can affect children through ideology. Through memes.
Yeah. Well, I think that shifting, like right now, those numbers are crazy. I don't think they'll last long because I think people are starting, you know, they're waking up to that, you know, mm-hmm. You know, parents are starting to homeschool, you know, or send to private school, like in a way that hadn't been done before as in retaliation to some of that. So,
yeah.
You know, it's cool. Cause like I get to talk about a lot of things on the podcast and we never really like I don't like to get too far into the political sphere because I do have a pretty broad audience, you know, but I like this conversation, dude, because we're looking at the philosophies behind everything. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, for sure. I kind of assumed, because I watched a bunch of your shorts today, I kind of assumed you were more political because I just saw a clip you had on 2A or on gun ownership. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just assumed.
Yeah. Well, I am political, but I try not to go too far. Right. Only Fair because enough. I want to tick everybody off. You know, I don't want to get canceled on these platforms that I kind of need to spread the word, you know?
Yeah.
But I also want to talk about things. And I think that that is the problem in our society is that we don't talk, dude. Like, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I feel the same way. It's like, I don't want to, in a one way, like communication, like we're talking, but obviously listeners can't talk back to us. I wouldn't want to alienate someone who we otherwise could have dialogue with. So like that, it is like important to, you know, I would actually go way deeper into other political topics if it wasn't for that concern. And obviously things get taken the wrong way and when things get edited or they can be.
Yeah. And at the same time, it's okay to speak up and have an opinion, you know, that's not a bad thing at all either. So, but I think it's just, mm-hmm. it's just about balance. Dude, everything's about balance, right? You know, mm-hmm. you swing too far one way or you swing too far the other way. It's best when you're just kind of hanging in the balance, I think.
Totally. And actually to bring it back to the men's topic, you know, I do see a lot of young men. I mean, Jordan Peterson's a great example. And there's a lot of other figures that young men look up to that are kind of the opposite of what young men looked up to like 15 years ago. Like when I was in high school, there's no way Jordan Peterson would have been the guy that 15-year-olds look up to, right? It just wasn't. It was maybe the ultra, you know, not a guy wearing a suit who tells you to clean your room. Like that was definitely not what was cool in like 2005, let's say. But now I think young men are, let's say the Gen Z guys are feeling the negative fallout of going too far in individualism, too far and do whatever you want. It was important. Right, like a society that's too conservative can be oppressive, but that balance was passed a while ago. Right, most civil rights victories were won and great. It was really important. It's like a lot of things were really important, and then now there's a negative fallout, especially and then men suffer the most because a lot of you know looking at things just from a strategic perspective and not a moral perspective, conservative values are more testosterone driven. Right, even just conservative small c, conserving resources, conserving energy, conserving the way things were, you know, that is more useful when there's danger. And men are more useful when there's danger. When society's super safe and there's a huge abundance of food and resources, yeah, you can relax. You can be a little bit more focused on feelings and less on facts. You have that luxury. So, yeah, I think, you know, a lot of political and moral shifts are tied to biological imperatives as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that as we face, you know, the economic situation as well, you know, everybody's a liberal until it hurts them in the paycheck, you know? And mm-hmm. I think that as we start to face, okay, things are tightening up, it just becomes natural to say, okay, maybe I'm not going to vote for the guy that's going to take half of my paycheck, you know? And I think that affects, you know, I think that you start to shift when you start to align, you know, that's one of the biggest things I think that affects a culture that, you know, and it's the same concept of, you know, are we in abundance? Are we in poverty? And if I'm in poverty, I need to make steps to be not in poverty. And yeah, I think it changes your perspective a lot.
Yeah. And it's the cycle that you mentioned, you know, like we're perhaps entering harder times. So maybe, you know, the next generation of men won't have any of the insecurities of the last one and will laugh at their grandpas or something. Yeah. Who knows?
During the 2020 election, my 20-year-old son at the time, he was 18 at the time. I'm like, all right, so who are you voting for? He's like, can we vote for complete chaos and war and meltdown? Because I think we just need a reset. We all just need to go away and start over. Like, can we vote for the asteroid? You know, and I know a lot of young men that share that opinion of like, all right, whatever we've got going here is just not working. If this is the best we can come up with, you know, I think that we'll see a shift of people who are very disillusioned with the systems, and they're going to just mm-hmm. start making their own systems. So,
yeah, there's something I talk about in my podcast a lot. There's this guy, Alfred Korzybski, who invented general semantics. After World War One, he came up with this theory that because technology grows at an exponential rate, and law, and I mean, basically the hard sciences develop at an exponential rate, the soft sciences, which includes law and governance, but also pop culture, grows at an incremental rate. Every few generations, the difference is so big that you have to have a violent revolution to correct it. And he was like, you could kind of show this mathematically with the French Revolution and World War One and going back. And, you know, now it's happening at a more rapid pace than I think he would predict. And also, I don't think it has to be violence anymore. But the culture wars, I think, are actually a happily peaceful version of what will hopefully be a correction without necessarily killing each other in the streets.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be nice if we didn't have to, you know, shoot our neighbors or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is the Manlyhood Mancast.
Well, Ruwan, I know that we're getting to the end of the time that we've got, so I like to ask all my guests a couple questions. The first one is, what does it take to be a man?
You know, you prompted me with the question. I thought I'd have a sharp one-liner by now. But I would say it's doing the hard things that are called for in you. Whether it's responsibility to your dependents, and if you don't have dependents, it's responsibility to yourself because you are your own dependent. And, you know, to bring it back to maybe what some would consider dry biology, like that is what stimulates our androgen receptors, which is what masculinity is. And, you know, that is being a man.
Makes good sense. Good sense. If you were able to go back in time, you know, maybe hop in Marty McFly's DeLorean or whatever and have a conversation with 10-year-old Ruwan, what do you want to tell him?
I tell him that life has phases, and the phase he's in, because 10-year-old Ruwan was not a happy camper, this is a great time to be anabolic and build yourself, because there's going to be a time in your life where you're going to have to break things down. Some version of life is short, but every chapter is really interesting, and do what you can in that chapter.
Yeah, I think about that a lot too. Like, Like, I know you can't, like, I don't want to go back and change my past, right? But I wish that I had that encouragement to push through, you know? Because there were things that where I'm like, man, if I would have just pushed a little harder, things would have been a little better. Or I would have at least had a better attitude about it.
Yeah, and also the appreciation, like, it's the most cliche thing in the world, but, like, old people are jealous of youth, and then young people are jealous of old people's money or whatever, you know, so like whatever, there's always like a trade-off, right? And it's like, and I try to remind this, like my wife and I keep reminding ourselves, like when our baby is being the craziest and like we can't get her to sleep or whatever thing that's really annoying, there's going to be a time where this is not a problem anymore and we're going to miss it. And we always try to remind ourselves of this, like, you know, so what, I have to stay in bed for many hours because she'll only sleep on my chest. Like one day she's not going to sleep on my chest. And I try to remind myself of that, especially when things are unpleasant.
Yeah. Have you ever heard the country song, You're Gonna Miss This? Do you ever listen to country music at all?
No, not so much.
Yeah, I don't listen to a bunch either, but you need to Google You're Gonna Miss This. It's this exact sentiment, and it might make you tear up a little bit. It's worth listening to.
It sounds like a tearjerker.
What is your best advice for the men that are listening today?
Find what you're interested in and go really hard on it. Actually, I just said that this is on the tip of my mind, because I just said this to a guy who's like searching for his life purpose. I was speaking to him a few hours ago, and it's like he's got imposter syndrome, very common thing. And I told him, your imposter syndrome is probably right. Like, you probably are mediocre at this thing that you want to do. But if you really give yourself to it, in a year, you're going to be in the top 5%, because most people won't do that. So you probably do suck. Your imposter syndrome is not wrong, but it's telling you you have to, you know, go deeper into that subject.
I love that, because like most guys won't tell you the truth. So like maybe you do suck. Like that's okay.
Yeah.
That sounds like really good coaching advice, dude.
Yeah, you suck and you can get better. I mean, yeah. It's better than thinking you'll always suck, and it's better than thinking you're good when you actually suck.
Yeah, that it's truth, man. Truth is powerful.
Yeah.
So if our listeners want to connect with you and the work you're doing, what's the best place to send them, man?
Rwando.com has all my stuff. I'm on Instagram if you want to chat directly, and all my content's on YouTube. Newly on YouTube, but my podcast has been up for quite a while, Rwando Podcast, on all the apps.
Awesome. We'll make sure to link it in the show notes too, so you can click in the description, guys, and click through and check out Rwando's stuff. Dude, I'm really excited about having the chance to talk to you, man. I think I've learned a lot. I think we've had a pretty cool conversation, so it's good stuff.
Yeah,
man.
This was fun.
Awesome. I really appreciate it.
Till next time.
Rwando, thank you so much for being on the Manlyhood Mancast with us. Guys, if you are interested in the work that he is doing, make sure you check out the show notes, because we've got links to his projects there. So you can click through and check out the work he's doing. Make sure you subscribe to his podcast. Also, make sure you subscribe to this podcast. If you guys are liking what we're putting out here at Manlyhood, it's up to you to help us spread the word. So please, share it with a friend. Anyway, just want you guys to remember, I love you. I'm proud of you. And I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Manlyhood Mancast. If you want to be a better husband, father, leader, a better man, you need to join our private Facebook group, the Manlyhood Mancast. Join today. Please help us out with a like, comment, share, and subscribe. And check us out at manlyhood.com.